KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
If you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want in this town.
Everybody says show business.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
This week on The Business, it's Reality Palooza. Three producers of big unscripted hits, including The Hills, Intervention, and Top Chef, tell us about the reality of reality. Drama, tears, laughter. Is any of that stuff real? But first, it's the Hollywood News Banter. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone to Hollywood.
I'm joined today by my usual banter buddy, John Horn, but he is not in the studio. He is where, John? Where in the world is John Horn?
I am at Comic-Con International in San Diego, as you must always call Comic-Con.
Comic-Con is not exactly the fanboy, fangirl fest that it used to be. It's a gigantic piece of Hollywood business now.
Yeah, there still are a lot of fanboys and fangirls, more than 100,000, but it also has become a big marketing platform, a launch pad, if you will, for a lot of mostly big-budget Hollywood movies. So you'll see clips from Green Lantern, the new Harry Potter movie, The Expendables, the DreamWorks animated film Megamind, Scott Pilgrim vs. the World. The studios spend small fortunes bringing talent and filmmakers down here. There's a huge hall called Hall H where about 6,500 Comic-Con attendees sit, and they watch footage, and the studios hope that they come out of that tweeting and blogging about the great stuff they've seen at Comic-Con.
Yes, in a good way.
In a good way. I mean, several years ago, Warner Brothers brought Catwoman, and the movie was dead before the presentation was over. So it you better have a good movie, because this is a tough crowd, and if they don't like something, they will tell the world.
Meanwhile, here in Los Angeles, things could be slowing down. The Teamsters will have voted by the time this airs as to whether to approve a strike authorization. I don't think they'll necessarily walk off the job instantly, but that threat does lurk.
This is a very interesting test case of how Hollywood labor is going to shake out. Now, the Writers Guild in 2007 walked off for 100 days, and a lot of that was over creative issues. You know, it all came down to money, but what was online content going to be? How was it going to be defined? This is really about money. Will the Teamsters get a 3% raise or a 2% raise? And the way Hollywood contracts are negotiated is they tend to go in lockstep. So the Teamsters go, and then this fall, SAG and AFTRA starts their negotiations, and then the DGA and the Writers Guild are in the wings. So what happens with the Teamsters, even though it's not a critical guild, they could shut down a lot of production, will really, I think, set the table for how the rest of the contract negotiations are going to unfold.
Now, we have seen one of the studio chiefs address not this question, but leave a voicemail for a reporter. This has been the talk of Hollywood this past week. Sumner Redstone called Peter Loria of the Daily Beast. Peter Loria had written a story about how Sumner Redstone was smitten with a, as he puts it, a scantily clad new all-girl group dubbed the Electric Barbarellas and forced MTV to air a reality show about this band over many, the objections of many MTV executives, including the MTV network CEO, Judy McGrath. And once Peter had written that story, Sumner Redstone made this stunning and interesting decision to call him up. I think we have a little tape. Now, bear in mind that this tape is taped off of a voicemail that was posted online. So the sound quality is what it is, but here it is.
I know you may be reluctant. We have to have the name of the person who gave you that story in the New York Post. We're not going to kill him. Just want to talk to him. We're not going to fire him. Just want to talk to him.
I thought it was very quaint, though, the chairman of a company trying to pry out information from a journalist. In some ways, it was so silly, it was almost brilliant.
It was, but you know, okay, Tiger Woods, Mel Gibson, Sumner, do these people not, I mean, Sumner Redstone is 87 years old, so maybe he doesn't, but seriously, when are people going to start just pausing to reflect that somebody might be recording what they write or saving their texts. I mean, is there an education lag here about the digital revolution?
I think you and I both know never leave something on a voicemail or send an email that you don't want to have read aloud by strangers.
A lesson that we must all bear in mind, although it would not be good for our business, would it, John?
Well, it can't be that great for Viacom's business either, but I think studio executives and agents and publicists always want to know who is leaking stuff. I mean, I'm sure they try to figure it out. They ask their friends. They ask their colleagues. I think what's revealing about the voicemail is that even though Sumner says he kind of wasn't really, or it's not that bad of an idea that the Electric Barbarellas have their own show, he clearly cares about this way too much, or he wouldn't be calling the reporter to try to figure out his source. It's not so much that it seems it's about who the leaker was, but about the fate of the Electric Barbarellas and will they finally get their MTV show.
And yes, we'll have to wait and find out. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
John Horn of the Los Angeles Times.
Top Chef.
Despite the recent renaissance of scripted programming on TV, reality shows are still booming. According to Film LA, a nonprofit that keeps track of permits for productions shooting in Los Angeles, the number of permits for reality shows has grown 42.5% since 2009. Unscripted programming includes everything: docu-soaps, dating shows, makeover shows, shiny floor shows. We'll explain that term a little later. Some feature celebrities, but mostly regular people are the stars. Perhaps Alan Funt's long-running Candid Camera, which started way back in the 40s, set the stage for the current reality show era. But it wasn't until the early 90s, when MTV put seven kids in an apartment and filmed what happened, that studios began to get the idea that there might be a genre in there that would have vast appeal. By now, reality has burgeoned, not just because audiences like it, but because most of these shows are much cheaper to produce than scripted programs. Sure, there's a downside. The shows don't repeat or make big sales in syndication, but the studios don't have to pay union rates, which makes these shows especially useful whenever Hollywood is facing a potential strike by writers or actors. The current reality boom began in 2000, when Survivor broke through for CBS. That same summer, Fox ran American High, a lauded documentary series produced by R.J. Cutler and directed by one of our guests today, Dan Partland. Dan is now executive producer of A&E's Intervention, a show in which friends and families try to convince addicts to go into rehab. We're also talking today with Sean Travis, who started out as an editor on The Real World. Most recently, he was executive producer of The Hills, the series about a group of friends looking to make it in Hollywood, which just wrapped after a six-year run on MTV. Rounding out our panel is Jane Lipsitz, a partner in Magical Elves, the production company behind shows including Project Runway, Top Chef, Work of Art, and The Real L Word. She got her start on the VH1 show, Bands on the Run, and HBO's Project Greenlight. Today, these three producers will take us into the real world of reality TV. The success, I guess, a reality like all television is in casting to a huge degree. And Dan, I assume for Intervention, well, I don't know if I should make an assumption. I was going to say you may have to actually look for people who are willing to have that on television, but maybe you have to fight them off.
Yeah, Intervention has kind of a different equation than what we crudely call casting than most shows. But it isn't that we don't have many people applying to the show. We have about 1,000 families apply to the show per week.
Per week. Isn't that a stunning number? I guess, are you guys not surprised, right? No, they're shaking their heads. Okay, go on.
You know, I think that it's a much more difficult show to pick stories on because the subjects are not eager to be on TV the way they are for a typical reality show. They don't feel like they necessarily benefit from the exposure, and they're not pursuing celebrity, and they don't have this great career ambition that they're trying to advance. If anything, the strength of the stories comes from, on some level, the reluctance of the characters to participate. They typically have mixed feelings about it, at least in the case of the addict, because they have a mixed feeling about their addiction. They typically, addicts who agree to be on the show, they have a certain measure of altruism to their participation, which is that they are entering into this with an equation that in a sense is out of balance. They get nothing for this experience as far as they know.
They ultimately have to sign a release.
They sign a release and they say that they're willing to tell their story. But typically, one of the things we look for to make sure someone is really invested in being on the show is that they have a reason for doing it. And the reason that they typically have is that they recognize that their situation is really dire and they hope that other people will benefit from hearing their story.
So do you say, well, we can't have another guy who lives in a trailer park? Or do you try to mix it up in a certain way?
We do. We try to mix it up on sort of every different level of the profile of the addict and the family and the part of the country and the addiction. And
you ever go out on Craigslist, say, we need an Asian meth addict?
Never.
Okay.
Absolutely not.
just wondering. It sort of popped into my mind that you might run short of certain demographics.
We actually don't. The 1,000 a week that come to us are plenty.
And what about you, Jane? What do you look, do you have, cause you, if you just sort of think about it in a very quick, facile way, you think, oh, you need a black person and a white person and a person with a big mouth and the bad guy. I mean, do you have a certain list in your head, like this will be the bad guy going in?
We learned a very important lesson in season one of Project Runway, which was we set out to say, you know, this show has to be relatable and we need to find a housewife somewhere who gave up her dream for her children and a family and someone who really had aspirations to make a success and a lost opportunity. And so we cast a woman who was that perfect person. She was in tears at the audition. She was calling her father and her family, and we were like, this is it. And we cast her on the first season, and her name was Wendy Pepper, and she, within one episode, turned out to be the villain of the season. So we learned a very important lesson, which is, you know, you can try and create the reality of what you want, but you can't control people and who they turn out to be. And I think that that's why we love doing it, is because you get this cast and it's amazing. And I think on the competitive, we look for a good mix of skill level and people who are good for television and who are going to be appealing and rootable. And a lot of those decisions go into it, but we never count on creating the perfect cast.
Now, Sean, The Hills. How foreseeable was the chemistry on that show?
That show was such a surprise to all of us, I think. When we started season one, we did have what we thought was the story. Two best friends moving to Los Angeles and teenagers becoming young women and starting into this world of Hollywood. With a docusoap, it's very hard. You know, we're looking at an order of 13 episodes and hoping that some drama will happen and asking as many questions as we can of this cast that we think is entertaining. But that show has just kept being a surprise to all of us and became something that, I mean, nobody knew that it would last that long or that characters like Spencer Pratt would come into the picture and Brody and that the girls would get so famous. And, you know, it was just a moving target.
When John and Kate were splitting up, I did an interview with Ted Harbert, who runs some of the Comcast networks, including E! And he was saying, you know, at a certain point, if you have a John and Kate and they're not John and Kate anymore, it becomes borderline impossible to keep that show.
We face that with The Hills for sure. It becomes increasingly hard to tell the story that we are interested in as our cast becomes really famous and successful because of the reality show. So the story kind of contaminates itself. And so it becomes harder and harder to find what's really going on in the private lives of these kids.
I mean, do you think that they're staging stuff that you even don't even want them to stage?
Absolutely.
On The Hills.
Yeah.
I mean, do you find that with Jane or you know, Dan?
I think there's an awareness, there's a sort of camera awareness that most subjects of any nonfiction show have at this point. I mean, when we were doing American High in 2000 and all these forms were still very new, but people had a sense based on the real world cast, like, I want to be the Puck, you know? I mean, people had a character that they knew from TV that they kind of could see themselves being. There's a way that that hampers sometimes what you're trying to get, but there's also something kind of on another level that's really honest and authentic about that, which is that's the kind of kid who idolizes Puck. That's who he sees himself as, and he's just really being who he aspires to be.
If you're just joining us, this is The Business, and we're talking about reality television with producers Dan Partland from A&E's Intervention, Sean Travis from The Real World and The Hills, and Jane Lipsitz of Top Chef and The Real L Word. Do you ever stop the cameras and say, look, this is really phony and it feels untrue to who you are and you guys, I don't know what you're thinking you're doing here, but this is not convincing at all?
I think if you're doing an interview and they're being really self-conscious and trying to give you the answers that they think, you know, you want them to, it's this whole like sort of mind game. And I mean, we always say, you know, you will be doing yourself a disservice if you're trying to create a character, because what you can't control is what everyone else is saying about you. And so they think that they're creating this character and they've got it all under control, but ultimately all the events around them, they can't control. And so we try and push everyone to be as authentic as possible, even if their authentic self is that person who wants to be on television, then that's who they are.
They got to embrace that.
Yeah.
So Dan, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, yeah, to jump in on that, I think every different show has a different premium on authenticity. They're not all authentic across the board or even in the same way. The Hills, I think there's a very small premium on authenticity. I don't really care whether
Sean,
those are their
laugh.
Real lives or not, or, you know, those aren't their houses or whatever it is. I don't think that that's really important to that show. Obviously, Intervention's the other end of the spectrum. I think if it weren't real and if people felt that it was phony, we wouldn't have much value to it. But the vast spectrum in the middle is kind of where it gets interesting. You know, I did this show that I thought was fantastic called Driving Force. It was two seasons on A&E, and it was a sort of celeb reality show about John Force, who's a drag racing legend, and about his life with his daughters who were aspiring drag racers. You know, in that show, it didn't have the heavy stakes and importance of Intervention, where we feel an almost journalistic need to sort of get it exactly right. It was for fun. On the other hand, all of our gold, the good material for that show, was all of the most honest, real, authentic stuff. And so we would build shows around that. And some of the connective tissue didn't really matter that much if, you know what, we have to show somebody walking into the house. Like, let's get a shot of him walking into the house. We would never do that for Intervention. I think it just works in the same way as scripted stuff works, that there's a willing suspension of disbelief on these things that are kind of fun. When you watch Jake Gyllenhaal and he's the king of Persia, you're doing willing suspension of disbelief on everything.
So with these three, we'll sort of go in a row with three different, very different types of shows. I mean, it's almost like you, Sean, are the least probably reality. And maybe you, Dan, with Intervention are the most, I don't know, I'm giving you the benefit of the doubt here.
I hope so.
Yeah. I mean, do you hear notes from the studio? Do they look at your dailies? Do they look at cuts and say, we want more, you know, bad guy? I mean, Jane, does that happen for Top Chef?
I would say it's fair to say that we get a lot of network notes.
What are they looking for?
We have to balance explaining the challenges, the process of the challenges, the winner, the people come in the middle, the people who are going to lose, you know, that the process of the show and the game, essentially, with character development and story arc. And so, you know, the network keeps an eye out on, are we getting the balance of that right? Does the show have enough feel-good versus conflict? Those are all the kinds of notes that we get.
Sean, you look like you got a thought in your mind.
Every reality show, I feel like, is an experiment, you know? And that's the fun part, is that instead of just writing anything we want to in a drama, we kind of have an experiment. We hope that that will produce something compelling that we can then craft into a show. And the experiment on The Hills, which started with Laguna Beach, was to make something that looked like a scripted show, without the use of interviews, to make a compelling, dramatic story that was addictive and entertaining and lush.
Yeah, what a shame it didn't work. No, I'm kidding. It worked.
Right. I know. Well, yeah, and it worked, you know, almost too well, because then it's, you know, now it looks like a scripted show.
Doesn't feel as much
I think after a while it just doesn't feel. Yeah, I think at the end of the day, we want to get that camera on our handheld on our shoulder and follow something really compelling and fresh again, you know?
Coming up after a short break, more behind the scenes on reality television. How real do you think reality television really is? Tell us on the comment page for today's show at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You're listening to The Business from KCRW and kcrw.com. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Today, we're talking about reality television. Our guests are Dan Partland, executive producer of A&E's Intervention, Sean Travis, until recently executive producer of The Hills, and Jane Lipsitz, a partner in Magical Elves, the production company behind Top Chef and The Real L Word. One of the questions that people always ask about so-called reality is, how real is it? How much is staged? I asked Sean Travis of The Hills to explain what is meant when a show is described in the business as soft scripted.
I imagine it means that there's a plan. You know, you have an idea of the events in your life that we're going to follow, you know?
Right.
But I can't think of any examples where the stories are actually scripted, makeups and breakups and things like that. I think we would like to do that. And on our show on The Hills, season one, we wanted this show to end with Lauren breaking up with her boyfriend and sailing off into the sunset to Paris to work for Teen Vogue. Any sensible girl would do that. That's a good story. That's the way it should go. You know, he's a whatever. It's not working out. But she wouldn't do it. The character didn't do it. So our soft script in that case didn't work. And we had to tell a story and somehow make it compelling that she didn't take the job and she stayed in Los Angeles with the wrong guy.
Will you do retakes? Like, you know, you just told him you don't like him anymore. Could you tell him again?
On The Hills, we didn't have interviews. So our version of a retake would be, especially if we missed something dramatic, like, oh my God, you know, somebody got arrested last night or broke up last night. So we would have Jane, can you go over to Dan's and talk about what happened last night? And if we could hopefully get the cameras going before they've already had the conversation so we can get it for the first time. To make the show stylish, we shoot entrances and exits and we try our best to stage those things with our cameras.
But
to
is
be
there
there
a line? You can't say, go pretend to break up with him again?
I don't think so. I mean, no, it doesn't wash, you know, it doesn't play.
I assume you don't re-intervene, Dan, when you, like, could you tell him that part again about how he screwed up your birthday party?
For us, there's this huge premium on it being authentic, and so we really can't do anything like that. It's also very complicated. I mean, we have to be extremely disciplined in how we talk to the subjects of the show. We just say, until we're blue in the face, do what you're going to do or do, you know, and they say, well, do you want me to go over to my sister's house? Like, I don't know. Go if that's what you're inclined to do because it would very quickly get muddy.
And what about Jane? Do you have, could you chop that celery again?
No, because we're a competition with real money on the line. I mean, we are actually very strictly governed by the rules of the competition. So we have something called the line where camera operators, audio producers, you know, you're not supposed to cross the line to the contestants. We can't have impropriety in any way. I mean, there's a lot of rules.
But that's true for the competition. It's not necessarily for the docu-soap type of thing.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely more leniency in the docu-soap area because there isn't money at the end of the road. And so it's really about, that's more about the relationship that you have as a documentarian with your subjects. I think some people like to maintain more of a distance and because they like to be impartial. And then I think there's another means of producing where you sort of become friends with them and gain their trust and then, you know, so it all depends. I think that's our job as producers to assess the situation we're faced with and, you know, being sensitive to the person that you're documenting or working with.
Well, yes, but the show has to be dramatic and interesting. So I would assume there's some tension in that because if they're boring, maybe you have to get a little cattle prod out there, don't you, and say, get them to somehow be less boring?
I mean, we're pretty honest. We say, you know what, you guys are being really boring. I mean, like, you know, it's like this is not going to work.
There's been sporadic attempts on the part of the Writers Guild to organize and to say that these are written or at least partially written. Dan, you're the one whose shows are guilt, right?
That's right.
So how is it that your show, which you seem to be arguing is the more journalistic show, is the one that's nonetheless a Writers Guild show?
There's probably no good reason for it. It's a bit of an anomaly. I mean, the Writers Guild is that's a more complicated issue. I think obviously they need to sort of re-understand what writing might mean, you know.
The Guild does?
The Guild. I think they would like to interpret writing as content creation.
Forming a story. Right.
Forming a story. But I don't think they quite have the formula yet for what would work for them. And I don't think the culture of the WGA has been too interested in taking on reality shows. They're becoming interested in it now, but the initial reaction was to really view reality as this upstart in the business that was taking all of their jobs. And so they really didn't want to include that under the Writers Guild. And I think that only just now they're making a lot of efforts to try to make progress in that area. And, you know, the problem is it's been 10 years. And in those 10 years, a lot of great talent in the industry has moved into this nonfiction arena because that's been the growth area right. for 10 years. So a lot of people, you know, yeah, why would you try to go get a job and script it and start writing scripts when all those writers are out of work and they have great credits? So well, try something different. So I think the Writers Guild, if they want to, you know, get some traction in the nonfiction area, they have a lot of work to do.
You know, you have the producers in the field who are writing the interview questions, who are tracking the story, who are figuring out who who likes who and who's got conflict with you. And then you've got the loggers who sit and log and they star the important things and they think about, you know, wow, this is a great scene that no one noticed in the field. And then they pass it over to, you know, what we call our story department who definitely piece together episodes, but then they turn that over to the editors and then the editors create the whole story in the bays. And I mean, I just feel like there's so many people involved in the actual creation of the story that it's really hard to identify who you would give that credit to.
I'm sure the guild would say they're all writers, right?
Yeah, it's as if everyone on the entire team is a writer from the cast. I mean, the cast could say, well, we're the ones who came up with the words. No matter how much you say, you know, so who's the writer? We're all the writers, but reality is like an experiment and a production and a puzzle that we all
would
put
it be
together.
A negative for your shows to be guild shows?
I would imagine there'd also be some costs associated with
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I was going to say.
You know, the thing about reality or unscripted is it's cost effective. And so I think the minute you try imposing costs that drive it up, then there are problems associated with that.
And let me just ask you generally, do you feel that there is a broad movement of genre in unscripted right now? Where the money is, where the heat is?
I think the shiny floor shows are still doing really well.
Meaning the aspirational house rebuilding, whatever.
No, the American Idol and
Dancing
with the
Stars.
Shows?
Shiny floor, yeah.
I've
not
heard
that.
That's
one you have to add to the list. Yeah.
What does that mean?
That's what it means.
They're literally they're on a shiny floor.
They're on a stage
American Idol,
on a shiny floor.
I thought it was like the house one where they remake the house and they put in a shiny floor.
Dancing with the Stars.
No, it's not a Mop and Glow reference. It's
America's Got Talent.
X Factor coming online, right?
I think those shows are all still doing really well. But I think there's also, I mean, in my sort of little area, there certainly has been a lot of growth. I mean, for a long time, Intervention was the only show out there in this space of being, you know, sort of the dark and psychological content. And that's just exploded in the past year or so with Hoarders and Obsessed and Animal
People
Hoarders.
With disorders.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a whole genre.
I think it's people are gravitating towards, I guess, more real reality. I mean, people are looking for more honest storytelling and maybe things that reflect, you know, more down-to-earth, more relatable.
Not so much here's The Bachelor with the Rose kind of thing.
The fairy tale.
Although Bachelor did so well this year.
I mean, The Bachelor's done
it almost
really
seems like an explosion in every direction on cable TV, you know, with so many networks and so many shows for so many different people.
And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Matt Holzman is our executive producer. The theme music mashup was designed by beat architect Jason Grohman. To leave a comment about today's show, go to kcrw.com/thebusiness, where you can also stream or podcast the show and check out past episodes. And you can always subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. The Business is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone to Hollywood.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.